There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
The president-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States elect.
This is a political upset of huge, huge magnitude.
The country still divided.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi and welcome back, listeners of the 45th podcast. This week I am here with Sarah and just me and her. Sarah, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm just a little tired because I'm moving house.
That's tough. Are you all done moving?
No, I'm actually supposed to be out exactly like next weekend pretty much. And it's just I come back so late from work that I just get to do all this stuff on the weekend. So
look, when we had to move a few months ago, I think I took like 3 months to do the actual packing and moving. So I understand it's tough to do that. But this too shall pass. So good luck with all that.
Yeah, but you were having a baby too at the same time.
I was. Yeah, I was heavily pregnant and I was moving like a glacier. So that wasn't a good time to be packing and moving. But anyhow, it gets done. It gets done. I mean, like at the end of the day, whenever things are like, I always think this too shall pass, you know, and I think that about the administration as well, by the way, but the 45th as well. Then we'll be ready for the 46th. So let's start off. As always, there's been a lot of news. We're going to do a little bit of a roundup of what happened this week, some of the highlights. Then get into a couple of issues, one that I'm going to talk about, one that Sarah's going to talk about that have kind of been on our minds. And then we're actually, it's been a while now, we will do some listener Q&As, which I'm excited about. All right, let's start off. Scaramucci, the Mooch. Did you read the article actually in the New Yorker written by Ryan Leza? Because he was the reporter that Scaramucci just randomly called late at night one night this past week.
No, I haven't read it.
Oh, God. Okay. It deserves to be read. It is called, this is the actual title, Anthony Scaramucci called me to unload about the White House leakers, Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon. It is an extraordinary piece. And it was an extraordinary conversation because of the things that this very new director of communications said to a reporter and then later tweeted and said, I will never trust a reporter again because the reporter did what he was supposed to do. He reported it.
Mm-hmm.
Scaramucci never told him that it was off the record. So he unloaded on Reince Priebus, who did very shortly thereafter, a couple days later, either resign or be forced out. That's a little bit up in the air.
I thought it was forced out.
You know, it kind of sounds like it because, let's just talk a little bit about what he said. It seems like Scaramucci believes that Reince was or is kind of the leaker. And I wonder if it's him saying that or if it's like because you know the president's been obsessed with who's leaking in the White House.
But what about Bannon? Didn't he mention Bannon as well?
He mentioned Bannon too. And he told a reporter, okay, I'm going to fire every one of them. And the entire place will be fired over the next 2 weeks. Because he was telling the reporter, I want you to tell me who the leaker is. Who is leaking stuff to you? The reporter said, I can't tell you that. Those are my sources. And so he said, oh, really? Is it an assistant to the president? If you're not telling me, then you haven't protected anybody because the entire place will be fired, which is kind of an interesting threat. And then, you know, he says, this is what he said. He goes, they'll all be fired by me. I fired one guy the other day. I have 3 to 4 people I'll fire tomorrow. I'll get to the person who leaked that to you. Reince Priebus, if you want to leak something, he'll be asked to resign very shortly. Reince is a fucking paranoid schizophrenic, a paranoiac. I didn't know that was a word, but oh well. Then he says, you know, let me leak the fucking thing and see if I can cock block these people the way I cock block Scaramucci for 6 months. And he's channeling Reince Priebus. He's saying that this is what Reince did to him because apparently the backstory and this beef is that Scaramucci back in January sold his business and he did just join the White House specifically. And since that time, he's been being blocked by certain people in the White House, including Bannon and Priebus, excuse me.
Wow.
How? I mean, like, basically, I guess they just discouraging the president to hire him. You know, after he was hired and, you know, Spicy was out the week before that, Scaramucci's financial disclosure form became public. It is a public document. Thought that it was some kind of a leak, so then he tweeted this really ridiculous thing where he tagged the FBI, and he's like, you know, I'm reporting this leak to the feds, and I'm talking to them. And he tagged Reince Priebus and said, I'm going to find the leaker and make sure he goes to prison type of thing, and saying that it was a felony. None of the sort. But anyhow, he tells this reporter, you know, I've called the FBI, I've called the Department of Justice, which if that did happen, by the way, those folks are not allowed to be talking about ongoing investigation to anybody. So that would have been a breach of ethics and protocol, too. He also said something about Bannon. Oh, wait a minute. He said, what I want to do is I want to fucking kill all the leakers, and I want to get the president's agenda on track so we can succeed for the American people. And then he I almost don't want to say what he said about Bannon. It was about self.
It's not bad.
Do you know what it is?
No, I didn't read that. I mean, I heard the overall summary, but I didn't read the verbatim stuff.
Oh, okay. Well, what he said about Bannon was, he goes, this is what the reporter is reporting. Scaramucci also told me that unlike other senior officials, he had no interest in media attention. Quote, I'm not Steve Bannon. I'm not trying to suck my own cock. I apologize to listeners everywhere for that. He said, speaking of Trump's chief strategist, I'm not trying to build my own brand off the fucking strength of the president. I'm here to serve the country. Now, and then the reporter notes that Bannon declined to comment, which I think is funny because that means somebody asked Bannon to comment on exactly what he just said. So incredibly profane, just remarkable. 3-4 days into this new position, and he is, you know, publicly attacking these people. Anyhow, Priebus, 2 days later, is out. And one thing I just want to mention about Scaramucci, because, you know, it's been kind of odd because, you know, as we all know, in the past, he's been very, he's been actually like openly critical of the president, right? Like in public. And so the question is, like, why is he so desperate now to work for the White House? Like, what happened in this time? His wife apparently just filed for divorce this week because she says, yeah.
Wow. Okay.
And because she filed for divorce, apparently, because she said he is power hungry. He's, you know, she hates Trump. She's very upset at this move he's making. But, you know, some people are, I'm sounding like Trump now, but apparently some people are saying that, you know, part of his desperation to work for the White House or, you know, to go completely to the bat for the president is that apparently the president holds the power to approve the sale of his company to this Chinese interest, which, you know, if it doesn't go through, it'll pretty much ruin him because he will have, you know, I mean, it'll hurt his chances to work in the White House, but also the sale is kind of, you know, obviously important to his business interests. And if the sale going through or not going through, you know, because there's an investigation, apparently there's an investigation ongoing as to this company and them acquiring his, I think it's a hedge fund. And that the president ultimately can be the one to direct the Treasury Department or whatever entities are investigating to just okay the sale. I mean, it's a theory. Maybe it's plausible. Anyway, it is what it is.
I didn't know that much.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. It was kind of a commentator on TV noted that this might be part of why he is so committed to very publicly defending the president. I don't know. But there's a new chief of staff now that Reince Priebus is out. Do you know who that is?
No, but, you know, it's very disconcerting because I feel like that was whatever, just at least some connection to the RNC or something a little along the traditional lines. Now I feel
Priebus, right?
Yeah. Now he's out. So it's what happens.
Right. I mean, so him and you know, Reince Priebus and Sean Spicer, I think, were kind of the two, you know, two old school conservative. They've been around working with the GOP for a long time and they're both gone now.
Right.
It's a career. Well, the guy filling Reince Priebus' shoes is not career Politico. It's retired General
Kelly.
John Kelly. Yeah, John Kelly, who previously was Homeland Security for DHS, Secretary of DHS, and now he's been tapped for that, and he's actually accepted it, which I think is an interesting choice on his part, given that he has been largely apolitical in his career. He is a very experienced battlefield commander. I remember when he was being considered for DHS, he did get pretty broad bipartisan support, but there were concerns in a lot of communities about him. What do you know about John Kelly? Anything?
Not much, but I feel like at this point, having, you know, so many military people around you is a little concerning. I mean,
well, he'll be the second one. He'll be the second appointment in the White House. And that means with H.R. McMaster, who is a national security advisor. And so two of the most senior positions now in the White House are, or ex-military.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
he did, you know, he lost his son in Afghanistan, in 2010. So he's experienced real loss. My concern with him is that, you know, he oversaw the military detention center in Guantanamo for a while, including during like the 2013 hunger strikes in which people died. He oversaw the exchange for Bo Bergdahl. That was kind of very high profile, the Taliban. And so, you know, and he has said some things that are kind of concerning. He does seem to inflate a lot of threats. You know, I mean, you hear kind of the same stuff that Trump's been saying about the rise in crime and the, which is empirically not true and things like that. But, you know, other than that, he's fairly well respected across the board. I just think it's a very bad choice for this particular position.
That's exactly what I was going to say, because I like him. I just don't know if, you know, you have to pick people, I guess, who have expertise in the area. And it's just a little concerning.
Well, let's see how it goes. I mean, brand new position. So let's see how it goes. In the meantime, DHS has no secretary. So there's that.
Hey listeners, how often do you think about your socks? If you're like I used to be, not much. That is, until my feet started to complain between flats and heels, slippers, and gym shoes. But I recently discovered socks that changed the way I'll think about socks forever. They're called Bombas. Bombas are the most comfortable socks in the history of feet. How do I know? Because when I try them, I can tell. They're made from premium cotton, they stay warm in the winter and cool in the summer, and every pair comes with a built-in blister tab, innovative arch support, stay-up technology, and a seamless toe. They've got lots of colors, patterns, lengths, and styles. They look good in the gym and in the office and out on the town. They are literally what feet daydream about. And for every Bombas purchase you make, Bombas donates a pair to somebody in need. I think that's really cool. So you can keep cool, keep comfortable, and keep contributing with the best socks in the history of feet with Bombas. Buy one pair or four at bombas.com/45th today and get 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/45th for 20% off. bombas.com/45th. Get your pair today.
All right, moving on. Next big news. This was big, big, big. The skinny repeal was defeated.
Oh, yeah. A lot of hatred, a lot of love. It's kind of love-hate mix for John McCain.
And
I guess overshadowing some of the most brave ladies were able to push back on it a little bit. So.
Right. Senator Collins and Murkowski, I think is her name, right?
Yep, Murkowski.
So, yeah, those two Republican ladies held the fort the entire time. They were like, well, we are not going to vote for this thing. And what happened was, so John McCain, I think did kind of this extraordinary strategic move, which, you know, there were two votes this past week. The first vote was whether or not to bring the bill to the floor, right? Mm-hmm. And at that point, everybody thought, okay, you know, John McCain can be the vote who actually stops this from even getting to the floor. But he, having had like surgery for apparently a brain tumor, then flies in to just place his vote and votes yes. And people were incensed. I was incensed because I'm like, are you kidding me? You're on taxpayer dime. You got health care. You just got surgery on, you know, with great health care coverage, and you just flew in to do this. Then the next day, when the actual vote, I was actually up watching the vote, stressed. Mm. I fell asleep in the middle of it, but then I woke up and I said, what happened? And I watched on repeat John McCain walking up like to the front, right in Mitch McConnell's face, and doing a thumbs down and saying no. So the question is, now this is really interesting. There's an analysis on Reddit, which, you know, once in a while Reddit comes in handy, by a commenter, and his handle is, wow, it's like 15 Z's and a 414. I can't even say it. It's like ZZZZZ414. That's his name. But this is what he says about this, and I think this is really interesting. He said that the Republicans were trying to pass this health care bill through a process called budget reconciliation. Because through that process, even though it's not a budget bill, but they've made the argument that it impacts budget. But what happens is when you pass it through that process, it protects the bill from being filibustered, and it only requires a simple majority of 50 votes instead of 60, okay? Yeah. So the problem is this. When you do something through a budget reconciliation process, you can only consider one bill topic per year. So if the bill dies in committee and it doesn't come to an official vote, it doesn't count. So this bill was allowed to come to the Senate floor specifically because John McCain went and said yes. Okay, he voted yes in the first vote. And, you know, even at the time, Murkowski and Collins voted no. The Democrats all voted no. McCain comes in and he says yes. And he, because he said yes, he allowed it to go to the floor where he voted no. By him doing that, they cannot, through this process, raise that bill again. Like that, that possibility of bringing the, because I think McConnell thought, we have enough through this process. All we need is a simple majority. We don't have to do the 60 votes. But he actually, he didn't know if he had the 50. He didn't even know if he had the simple majority, right?
Yeah.
And McCain, who... maybe he thought, you know, I don't know how long I'm going to be around, but I want to make sure I vote on this thing. That vote wouldn't have happened without him saying yes the first. So I thought it was, you know, if that's actually what happened, that's pretty smart.
I think it was more that I think when you're in that position, you're so loyal to what you have to get done that you're not thinking about what's going to happen to me. It's more like, I mean, it could very well be, but I think for him, it was more like, you know, let me give this thing a fair chance. Let's look at it, right? So,
I don't think so. I think he had absolutely no interest in that skinny repeal. It was 8 pages long that they wrote over lunch the day they voted for it. So the night before, when they voted for it to go to committee, they didn't even know what they were going to be voting for.
Well, there's no doubt it's not been prepared properly. That's obviously why it failed. Because I mean, repealing is fine. What do you
only had 7 years? What do you do? But here's the thing, though. So now they're in a place where they cannot use the budget reconciliation process in order to pass healthcare reform. They have to have a bill that is going to get 60 votes to pass, right? So that probably is not going to happen at this point, unless they come up with a bipartisan plan.
Well, maybe that's a tactic to, you know, draw the line and kind of like start fresh or sort of look at it in a different way where they have to have a majority approval of it rather than this going back and forth. And it's
whose tactic?
So
whose tactic? It wasn't the GOP's tactic. 49 GOP senators voted for this and they were going to go forward with it. McCain's the one who saved it.
Maybe it's his. Maybe he feels like he had to do this to get it to be the wipe the slate clean to some degree and get like huge support behind something that's either bipartisan or something looks completely different.
Yeah, I think that's what the maverick did. So I think, you know, and since that time, the president keeps tweeting about, you know, go with the nuclear option, get rid of the 60, because he knows now they need 60 votes to pass something. It's killing him that they didn't repeal anything, didn't pass anything. And you know, that's another possibility. Mitch McConnell could be like, I'm changing the rules and we're going to go to simple majority. And so that would have defeated. Although, even if he does that, McCain, that might piss him off enough to the point where he goes, no, I'm still not going to be with you. Anyhow, that's the skinny repeal is gone. I'm thankful for that. Maybe it'll force them to be much more thoughtful and careful and take their time to do this. Like, what is the rush is the real question.
You know, I think for me, this issue is so tricky because I've worked in civic engagement at the local level and I've seen senators and members of Congress who actually, you know, at state level really do believe in the Medicaid expansion, even if it's Republicans, because look, let's face it, people do need a basic net, right? They do need something very basic. It has helped, but it's got other problems attached to it. So I see the conundrum, I see the struggle, and it's sad that nothing can be really achieved on this front, but at the same time,
Democrats see the same problems. Democrats have repeatedly publicly said, we are willing, we know this is not a perfect, Obamacare is not perfect. We are willing to work on things that need to be fixed. Like that has been an offer on the table from the beginning. But I think it's really about, for Trump at least, and maybe the GOP, because, you know, they've been railing against it for, you know, 7 years now. Now they're kind of stuck and they have to do something about it because they didn't stop talking about it. It became a campaign point for Trump. And I think it's about saving face at this point instead of really being thoughtful. So anyhow, let's see. I mean, like it's not, this debate's not going away, but anyhow, I'm glad this week we were relatively unscathed. Moving on to other quick things that happened. This, I'm saying quick things like they're little things. North Korea just tested another missile a couple days ago.
Yeah.
Yep. Another ICBM. Intercontinental ballistic missile.
That got hidden in there somewhere. Stories.
I think by the time this happened, Trump was already on the links playing golf. But here's the problem. This particular missile. I mean, we talked about this in the past where potentially any one of their missiles could easily reach the mainland. But this one, clearly, like U.S. cities are, it's being reported that U.S. cities, Los Angeles, Denver, Chicago, are well, well within its range. And it could probably get to New York and Boston. Kim himself says that he claims that the entire U.S. mainland is now in reach. So, you know, that was a little bit not good. What I have heard from a source inside the State Department is that state folks are really being cut out of a lot of these processes. Like, instead of being, like, Tillerson and others in high-level senior positions, the State Department being involved in conversations in the White House on how to proceed on these issues. I mean, these are issues that Tillerson should be part of the conversation. They're having...
Oh, God, yeah.
They're having meetings without state folks involved, without experts involved. And he really... believe strongly that...
And you mean the White House when you say they.
The White House, right. They've been having closed-door meetings with people on issues like North Korea, on Iran, on Venezuela, apparently. And this particular source really strongly believes... I mean, he said this to me earlier this week where he said that he really thinks that the White House is getting in position to carry out a strike against either Iran or North Korea, or those are the two most likely places. Given
wow.
this, yeah, given this, yeah, he really does believe it, and he also has obviously other colleagues, and he's in a senior position. He has other colleagues who have said that they also think there's more than 50% chance that there's going to be a strike on North Korea by this administration very, very soon in the next couple of weeks. So let's see. I mean, I don't know. In the next couple of weeks, and you know the calculation here is, and then what does North Korea do? What do they do to South Korea? What about Japan? How does right?
It might be World War III. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's not like North Korea could survive this, but I feel like they're the kind of, you know, it's the kind of regime that's like, we might not survive, but we're making sure we're taking people with us. If Trump is going to carry out a strike in order to do whatever, I think it's exciting to him. I think he thinks it'll be a distraction. It'll be kind of like those campaign rallies. Look, if he carries out a strike against North Korea, who's going to say that was wrong? Like, who's going to be like, who's going to like, nobody's going to protest against it, right?
I don't think, unless there's really compelling circumstances that get us to that point, that even his more immediate surroundings would go that way. I don't know. I just,
well, let's see.
My gut let's tells see. Me that, but then I could be wrong.
Yeah, our guts are all over the place with this guy. But I can see this happening given Trump wants a win. You know, there hasn't been a lot of winning lately. It could be an easy win. A strike on Iran.
Wars can sometimes, or military attacks can also make you highly unpopular if they don't. So it's a huge risk to take.
I think a strike against North Korea would not be as unpopular. One against Iran might be, but a strike against North Korea would have, I think, much more major repercussions than a strike against Iran. But, you know, we don't know if any of this is going to happen, but we do know, like I said, both North Korea and I think Iran also did some testing this past week, but let's see what happens. Lastly, I just want to mention this really, really weird thing that happened, which is the president, through Twitter, announced that transgender service folks will no longer be welcome in the military through Twitter.
How did that slip my radar? I didn't see that.
Oh, goodness. Well, I know you've been moving. It was a big deal. It still is a big deal. It affects thousands of service people in the military. And he did it via tweet, but he did it in a way... You know, the response from the Pentagon was like, hello, we have not heard anything about this. We know nothing about this. And not only that, they're actually, I mean, top generals in the Pentagon are like, this is not an order for us to follow. It's a tweet. So,
oh, wow.
As of now, transgender people are still going to be serving in the U.S. military. But was that a signal to the evangelicals? I don't know what he's trying to do. So,
what? That's so weird. I mean, transgender, and then you just leave out just plain, you know, you leave out homosexual, but you just, why did he wake up with that one category? It's so weird. I mean,
I don't know, but it might have something to do with the ongoing GOP battle of allowing transgender people to use the restroom they want to reuse. I mean, like, you know, that's been an ongoing thing in North Carolina and other places, the bathroom battle, right?
Yeah, but it's so random.
I really don't think he knows what the T for, you know, stands for in LGBTQ.
Yeah.
But that did happen. Well, that did happen. And so I, you know, it is.
But it's not official policy, right? It was just a tweet.
You know, he might not realize that. And now that he realizes that they're not going to like a tweet is not an order, a direct command to them, that they he might find another way to.
It's just sure whatever's on his mind that morning.
Well, a lot's been on his mind. And, you know, one thing, this week people are noticing that he is hitting record numbers of tweets. In 1 week alone, in the past week, from that last Sunday to Friday, he tweeted 78 times. That's a lot of tweets for a president who should be doing other stuff. So a lot of those tweets were either about the fake news Russia investigation or the healthcare bill. I mean, like, those are kind of the majority of things.
People trying to delineate what's actual policy and what's just a tweet from him.
You know, look, these tweets are part of official presidential record. A court has said that they're going to consider them as part of the president's, you know, actual policy stuff. Now, this is like uncharted territory, you know, so we don't know how this is going to go. So anyhow, that was kind of, was there anything I missed, any of the big news I missed in our little roundup?
I think you did well on the big stuff. Yeah.
Okay. So now there's two issues we're going to do a little deeper dive on. I want to talk about what's going on at the State Department. You're going to give us some great instruction I saw, and this is in response to like things that people have asked us many times about. What can they do on a local level to actually make a difference? And because you've done so much of that work, you know, I look forward to hearing what you have to teach us about that. But I will do I'm just going to do like 10 minutes on this, and that is what it seems to be like a very quick, in 6 months, unraveling of the State Department. There's a lot happening at the State Department. And when I say that, in a way, there's a lot happening, but at the same time, it's unraveling. So a lot of things are not happening that should be happening. A couple of things that I want to point out to, just to kind of show, like, so we can kind of understand, like, where the priorities of this administration are, what they seem to be through these actions. Number one, Tillerson announced that they are probably going to close the Office of War Crimes, which is kind of a big deal. The special coordinator in something called the Office of Global Criminal Justice was told by Tillerson that he's being reassigned to a new position in a new department, and that the entire staff might be reassigned, meaning that it'll be closed. State Department will not confirm or deny it. And you know, this is the office that advises Tillerson on issues surrounding war crimes and genocide.
Yeah, the concerning part about this is, does this mean that we are going to skim the budget and kind of step away from monitoring them or being a world leader on the stage of, you know, setting the standards for war crimes? Or are we just going to eliminate this so that we can do whatever we want overseas? And I think that's what makes people uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's a great point. It could be either one. And I think both things are terrible consequences of closing something like this. And it's certainly a signal. It's saying that war crimes and genocide are not a concern for us.
But Rabia, sometimes when things are skimmed in the government, and I'm not defending it because I don't know enough about this one particular thing, but you have to understand that perhaps the previous administration had stocked it up so much and there was so much red tape and so much bureaucracy that there is a need to skim it. I highly doubt that in this case, but I mean, I'm coming at it from a view that this guy wants to change out some things and feels that you've got to take the resources away from this area and put it somewhere else, or this doesn't need as much. So even if you wanted to give the benefit of the doubt, I think closing the actual office itself is probably not such a smart thing.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's a total possibility because over and over and again, he has said that we are going to be reorganizing the State Department. And in fact, Tillerson has hired two outside firms to help in the next year reorganize the State Department. But, you know, they say that a budget is a moral document. A budget reflects what your values and priorities are. And like you said, you know, it could, if they're completely closing this, or if they're reassigning the duties and somebody will be looking at these issues in a different capacity, then I think that's fair. But if they're taking it off the table completely, that's worrisome. What's also worrisome is this, that the State Department is shutting the door to a lot of fantastic new candidates. Basically, there's a lot of programs they're shutting down. One of them just recently was announced was a presidential management fellowship program.
You're kidding me.
Yeah.
PMF was such an integral way of getting people
recruiting
from, yeah, getting talent from.
Yep. So the PMF program, you know, they recruit cream of the crop graduates into the federal government, and they have decided to withdraw. The State Department is withdrawing themselves from this program. Top diplomats are like, astonished. They're like, that's where we get our best talent. We don't know if other agencies are going to do the same thing, but states like, nope, we're done with that. By the way, as they did this, they announced this through like the, you know, through a statement to the press, but actual PMF candidates never heard from them directly. So people who expect to get positions, like who have been talking to the State Department, an ongoing recruitment process, nothing, silence. They just saw this in the news. That's the end of it. So another thing they've ended is something called the Pickering and Rangel Fellows Program, which these are fellowships that are in the State Department. And from those fellows, people get, the commitment is that you will go from the fellowship to an actual appointment. Tillerson told them, nope, not going to happen. We're not going to honor that commitment. So no recruiting from the Fellows Program. So these are two, like, you know, major avenues that State Department recruited from. They're not really hiring any other people. They're not going to bring people in from there. Other things are defunding is the FLAS scholarship, which is a foreign language and area study scholarship, which what that did was it was a scholarship that gave American students the opportunity to study foreign languages and cultures overseas. Because, you know, when they do that, they can come back and be great civil foreign civil servants. If they've gone overseas and they have like the language skills and the cultural competency to come back and serve in positions as diplomats or on staff in these places. And so they're going to cut that. That is another avenue of recruitment to me that's cut.
I, you know, these to me have always remained or were traditionally there in Republican administration. So,
right.
I've actually, I know a lot of PMF fellows and they actually brought a lot of diversity and fresh blood and good views on things to the administration. And to not have that is just a prime example of how this is becoming an ivory tower administration where it's only the cronies that can join. We don't need the creativity. We don't need the new blood. We are going to handpick, cherry pick our people, and that's it.
Well, I don't know how you run a State Department that is not just about a building in D.C., but it's about, you know, having embassies and consulates all over in nearly every country in the world. But right now in DC, you know, there's 144 appointed positions at the State Department, 110 of them not only are empty, but they don't even have nominees yet. Like the president has not nominated people for these positions. So there is 110 out of 144. It's a very empty place right now. Yeah.
Good luck with North Korea.
Good luck with North Korea, exactly, and many other countries in the world, which maybe that's, they don't care about other countries in the world. But, you know, another thing that they're closing, because, you know, again, you got to look at this holistically, is they announced that Tillerson is considering closing the cyber office, the Office of the Coordinator for Cyber Issues, which was founded by Obama in 2011. And that is a really weird signal, because simultaneously, he has said that he will be working with Russia on three issues, you know, the Syria war, North Korea's missile defense program, and cybersecurity. So on one hand, yeah, go ahead.
Once again, you're closing it. What are you replacing it with? Because obviously you can't do without cybersecurity. And what is that other theoretical arrangement with Russia? I mean, none of this is this is not articulated, which is what's amazingly scary. Okay, if you have a problem with Obama's thing from 2011, that's fine. If you think it needs to be fixed or gotten rid of, that's fine. Just tell us what you're putting there in its place, because it's even a dodo knows.
To me, look, when you think about like why this reorganization is happening, there's a number of different reasons. Like you said, there's money concerns, budget concerns, right? But there is an absolute concern from this administration that like there is like all these Obama holdovers and they are going to subvert the administration's agenda. But when it comes to something like cybersecurity, don't we all have the same agenda? I mean, like, what is the agenda here? How is that even a political issue? I don't understand. It shouldn't be a political issue. And the only thing that seems possible about him replacing this existing Office of Cybersecurity, the State Department, which should be very concerned about cybersecurity, is that maybe he's going to replace it with Putin's cybersecurity folks.
No, I mean, even if it's something domestically our own, it's like, where is that going to be? And what, you know, what's it going to look like? You don't just say, I'm just going to create this big vacuum here. And whoop-de-doo, you know, what happens?
Yeah.
You know, I have to tell you, when I read these things, I kind of look at it. I look at who the source of the information is, who wrote the article or the media piece. And I kind of say, okay, is this left-leaning? Is this right-leaning? Is this reasonable? And
sure.
By any measure, okay, to say you're shutting down an entire bureau or a whole wing of something, it's concerning, because there was a reason it was set up, and you know, people need to know whether you're on the Dem side or the Rep side. You still need to know what the priorities of the administration are. And I really feel like not having these bureaus just kind of leads, obviously, I mean, this is the obvious thing, that it's obviously closing doors off to everybody just so that only a select group of people know how the White House is. And maybe it's even an effort to stop these leaks from happening, you know, just say, okay, cut everybody out that we think could leak things. It's crazy.
I mean, leaking stuff about cybersecurity, that just seems, I mean, these are professional, you know, people who are not political. Like you said, they're career folks who've been doing, and experts on these issues. And, you know,
there's
like,
no
we don't know yet.
There's no respect for
the expertise,
what they've done or the expertise. I mean,
I mean, it isn't closed yet. They made the announcement. A bunch of 24 Democratic legislators wrote a letter to Tillerson saying, please do not close this because we're sending terrible signals. And, you know, my daughter, who is starting her junior year this year at GW studying cybersecurity, recently had an orientation into the cybersecurity program. And the dean there told them, in the D.C. area, by the way, for people who need some job security, there are 15,000 unfulfilled cybersecurity positions because this is such a major concern right now, right? Like this is, it is a field of the future,
you know,
ad infinitum. Right, exactly. Yeah. So it's not that this is not a concern. It's a big concern. There are lots of jobs and, but apparently not the State Department. So, you know, the New York Times wrote a piece this week, which is a great piece, and I urge everybody to read it, called The Desperation of Our Diplomats. And it kind of summarizes the sinking feeling of, I mean, there other than all these, you know, closing this, defunding that, there is a general sense of, like, you know, really low morale at the State Department. And this is a quote directly from the article. The lack of communication between the secretary and the rest of the building has been deeply disturbing. An exodus is underway. Those who have departed include Nancy McIldowney, the director of the Foreign Service Institute, who described to the reporter a toxic, troubled environment and organization. Dana Shell Smith, the former ambassador to Qatar, who said what was most striking was a complete and utter disdain for our expertise, just like you said, Sarah. And Jake Walls, a former ambassador to Tunisia with some 35 years of experience, and he said it's a slow unraveling of the institution. The Truman National Security Project, which is actually, I'm a fellow of that organization, did a piece also this week, very alarmed at what's happening in state. And this is what they said. They said the Secretary of State, at the direction of President Trump, is currently engaging in a thorough slash and burn of DOS underneath the veneer of restructuring. Despite leaders at state frequently touting the organization's personnel as its greatest asset, Tillerson is aggressively hollowing out the department and stripping it of its leadership expertise and capability. These cuts by the Trump administration move beyond just the State Department cuts to programs meant to ensure that foreign area experts are well-trained, educated, and present in the workforce. From the halls of the Pentagon and embassies to corporate boardrooms are similarly being cut. So, now.
Well, let me ask you this then. What about that whole tiff between him and Trump that actually is still ongoing about wanting to hire the people that he needs? I mean, what's happening with that?
We don't know what's happening with that. Tillerson is, unlike many people in this administration, pretty closed mouth. He doesn't say a lot, but what he has done over last week has announced that he is going to take a little break. There are reports, and these are leaks, I guess, by many, including my source, the State Department, that it is very, very likely that Tillerson will resign before this year is over. And so this is a weird time to take a little break when North Korea just tested some missiles. And, you know, and things are getting very, very hairy also, by the way, in the Middle East, in Jerusalem. I'm sure you've been following that, too. So
yeah,
it's
been
bad timing.
Yeah, I honestly didn't think he would last this long either, by the way.
Well, you know, he apparently, you know, what I'm hearing is that, like I said, there are meetings happening at high levels of the White House that don't involve him, but should involve him. He's being sidelined and kind of rolled, you know, he says one thing about Qatar, Trump's tweet something else. He just doesn't have a lot of power in this situation. In the meantime, he's stripping the agency, and then maybe he'll leave. So I don't know how this is going to go down. But
is it just me, or was there absolutely not a squeak out of the White House on the Jerusalem issue? And usually, traditionally, the U.S. kind of makes a statement that sort of tries to calm both sides down. I didn't hear anything.
You know, I haven't heard any public statements by the White House. I do understand that there have been phone calls made and some meetings behind closed doors to try to quell the situation. And you know, that might be something good for us to get into next week to explain exactly what's happening there, why temperatures are rising and there's been a lot of conflict in the last couple of weeks.
This would be Jared Kushner's realm, right?
Maybe Kushner is really busy and he can't get to the Middle East conflict. I'm now going to turn it over to you, Sara, as you lead us through maybe something that will make us feel a little bit better, because it'll tell us that we can actually do something about some of these things.
Okay, so a lot of listeners have been writing in or expressing that they want to hear how they can get involved at the local level. And I spent a few years working on this, so I just thought I'd run through stuff just to give people some tools maybe to know what they can do in their immediate surroundings, because people feel, I think in this atmosphere especially, people feel kind of frustrated and they feel like they want something, they want to be able to do something about their situation or contribute in some way, because a lot of it is a sense of not being empowered to kind of change the paradigm that's coming from the federal government or through the federal level or from pretty much the White House. So people, you know, need to know that there are things that they could do at a local level. It's not going to be overnight changes, but obviously it's a process and you have to be involved in it to make anything happen. So the question was to how to get involved locally. So to begin with, I think understanding just kind of the overall landscape of how our government works is we're a constitutional representative democracy. That means that we elect representatives who make laws on behalf of us to ensure our individual rights. So obviously you have four levels of government that you could be involved in and you could look into, and that's a federal, state, county, and municipal. Now, according to the 10th Amendment of the Constitution, it says all powers that are not granted to the federal government are reserved for the states and people. So the state governments are pretty much set up like the federal system. They have an executive, a judicial, and a legislative branch. And the election of members to the bicameral bodies that you have, at each one of your general assemblies will have a House and a Senate side. And so basically at the state level, the state voters, if you're voting at the state level, you can pick a land commissioner, you can pick comptroller of the public accounts, attorney general, governor, lieutenant governor, state board of education, the commission of agriculture, and the railroad commissioner. So if you want to be involved at a state level or monitor legislation that's happening with your, you know, member of the House, your delegate or your senator, and you want to get involved in how the railroads work or the state board of education's working, that is the level at which you would have some influence. It would be at the state level. Now, there are three essential powers. There's the federal powers, there's concurrent powers, which is basically shared powers that you have between your state and the federal government. With the federal, at the federal level, yeah, you're going to be talking about, if you're working at a federal level, you could be helping with regulating trade and coin money and armed forces, maintaining armed forces, basically declaring war and establishing post offices and court systems. The concurrent powers, which are shared between the state and the federal courts, actually allow you to maintain law and order. That's where the taxes come in, levying of taxes, the borrowing of money, also how you use land for public use, and the general provision of public welfare. And what's specific to your state will be public education, punishing of criminals, conducting elections, and establishing local governments at the municipal level, and making marriage laws, which is interesting, Robbie, because when people come up with the whole issue of Sharia law, you know, Sharia, there's crazy people coming in with their Sharia stuff. Every state has its own kind of custom approach to how it handles divorce courts and marriage laws. And Sharia itself just deals mostly with how marriage laws are conducted. And sometimes, you know, every state has its own requirement. And usually, whether you're following the Jewish halakha or the canon or Sharia, you know, that's the level at which you'd be dealing is when you're talking about marriage laws.
Like
mostly.
Personal, right? Personal,
exactly. Kind of, yeah. It's domestic stuff. So And then you get down from the state to the county level. So what do the county do, okay? The county is responsible for making laws for the local county itself, for land development and roads and school districts, okay? So the laws are going to be basically the different courts that you deal, which is civil, criminal, family, and juvenile courts. And then who makes the laws for the county governments? Well, it's going to be the Board of Commissioners, who are elected by you, the resident. And then the other elected jobs that come at the county level are the sheriff, the tax collector, the supervisor of elections, and county judges. Now, if you really want to be involved at a micro level, but something that's very tangible to you, within each county, the cities and towns are set up with their own municipal governments, okay? And that's headed by the mayor and the city council, who oversee policies and decisions like public safety, police, fire, roads, parks and recreation, housing, transportation, and public works. Okay, and you as a voter elect a treasurer and the mayor himself and the city council members and the county assessor. So people always ask, you know, where do I start? How do I get involved? You know, what can I do as an individual? And, you know, it's very fine and dandy complaining about what's going on around you, but not being involved is like a crime if you just sit there and complain and you don't do anything about it, because every person's involvement counts. You can make a difference at a local level a lot more than you can at a federal level. So to sit down and whine about it is not going to help. You can get up and do something about it. So what are the ways that you can do it? And there are largely three ways, right? One would be voting. The other would be through legislation and advocacy. But let's look at voting. There, every state, and I guess counties make it really as simple as they can for people to get out to vote. And yes, of course, it depends on how well-funded your state, your locality is. But there are tools at the tips of your fingers that can allow you to vote and make it really easy on you. I can talk about Virginia, but essentially, we have things like you can actually mail in your vote ahead of time. Say for even something as small as I'm traveling around that time frame, I need to get it done now. Or you can, if you're overseas, you can vote in absentee. And all these things are available online. Sometimes you have to have a paper ballot, you know, and actually fill it out before you leave or mail it in. There is such thing as early voting in most states. And then there's actual election day voting, which is when you walk yourself over the precinct and cast your vote. The other way that people don't realize is these members of your General Assembly in your state are hired by you. They are elected by you. They are answerable to you. And people don't realize that they have direct access to these people and that they can literally walk into their office, make appointments, and walk in. But influencing legislation is actually a big deal. You can actually do that at a local level. So what you do is you lobby, you use your party as a platform, you can join or support interest groups. But basically what you do is you use a bicameral system, the upper chamber, which is the Senate side. In Virginia, we have 40 members with four-year terms. And then the lower side, which is the House side, you have 100 members with two-year terms. But at the end of the legislation, what happens is it goes through a legislative session, and then you have the governor who actually determines whether or not he's going to veto the bill or he's going to sign it, you know, into law, or if he's going to send it back for an amendment. And basically, it has to go through a two-thirds vote at each level for it to be passed as law.
Let me ask something. So my question to you is, like, so this is how the system's set up. Like, let's say there's an issue that I'm really, like, passionate about, and I want to see some kind of a, like, legislative change or introducing a new bill, or how do I influence any of these legislators?
So this is what happens. You have to know when the legislative session is in your state, okay? Once you figure that out, ahead of time, you start to do research on your issue. So you'd start out, for instance, in Virginia, it would be in December because the session starts in January. What you would do is do research on your issue, see what else is out there, who the interest groups are, who the lobbying groups are, what's already been done, get partners in on it. And then you decide to find out who your reps are. Who are the people that are ideal for you to reach out to? Like, is it your delegate for your local area? Is it your senator? Who's it going to be that you're going to call the patron of your bill or your idea? So you chalk this all out before the legislative session, you start your work. And the work is basically advocacy. Okay, so between the legislative sessions, you when the members are in their districts, you find organizations that support your cause. You identify the rep that you're going to reach out to. You start to do research, which is pulling out data and studies on that issue, and then you start a direct action campaign with letters and lobbying and decision makers, attending public hearings, and you know, using the media as much as you can. Nowadays, you've got this extra tool of social media and electronic advocacy that you can use, which is kind of different from, you know, you can go and find a Facebook for the cause that you're trying to fight for.
Right.
So what you do is you start to, before the legislative session, you take your issue and take your partners with you if you want. But what you do is you make a one pager that just kind of summarizes your issue, because let's face it, okay, delegates and senators don't have time to read really lengthy things. They kind of look at everything in a page and you're done. And most of the time, I'll be honest with you, they don't even look at it. The chief of staff of the LD or the LA looks at it and kind of helps them to make decisions on stuff. And oftentimes I've actually seen this happen.
Well, how do you get a one pager to them? Do you just email it to them, or what do you do?
So, and this is a great question. So there's two ways you can do it. One really effective way, which is to actually get it to them in person. So people don't realize, because they get intimidated, but you have access to your delegate directly and your senator. You can actually just pick up the phone, make a 15 to 30 minute appointment with them, head out that way. And even if your lawmaker is not present at that meeting, and sometimes it's not necessary because the chief of staff is actually much more powerful than you think because they have their ear all the time, you make that appointment with them, you go in for the appointment with your one pager, and you remember to leave as much of a mark as you can, which is leave the one pager on their desk, leave your contact information, take pictures of the fact that you visited them. But what you do is you go in, you have to have a very effective conversation, because this has happened before where a delegate sits there and he doesn't really have interest in your issue, but he just, you know, had to have you on his schedule. You come in and you're trying to have this conversation that's very on point with what you're trying to discuss. And this delegate is kind of going around and around in circles because they don't want to get to the issue, right? So you have to really know how to reel them in, keep them focused, be on point, because you don't get a long time with them. They're very busy people. So what you do is you provide all that information. You actually practice what you're going to say in that limited time. And you got to be, you know, tactful at what you're going to say and try to get to the point. And never leave without leaving some way for them to contact you again.
Okay, I have a couple questions already. Number one,
yeah,
is the point here trying to get legislators on board who might already be inclined to your issue, or is it more effective to be reaching out and trying to convince people that you think historically have not supported like an issue like yours?
Well, there's actually a couple of ways to do it. You might be fighting a cause that's already on the table, which means that you have certain people that are invested in it already that you need to be reaching out to and kind of lobbying and pushing. So in that case, you don't have much choice. You're dealing with the usual people that you need to be pushing. And then if you're coming up, but the other side of this, if you're coming up with a totally different new idea, you have to vet these people to a new idea. So what you have to do is find someone who's going to carry your bill through the bicameral General Assembly. And that would be either a delegate or a senator that you call a patron of your bill. So if they look at it and they go, you know, Robbie, this is a really good idea. We should do this. And guess what? We can make it a bipartisan bill because my friend on the other side would love this. And so you can started off as a bipartisan co-patrons on it, where it's both sides, or they can say, you know what, they can be sneaky or just, you know, very politician about it and kind of go, hey, you know, this would be great for our PR, or this is a great cause. I'm just going to be the patron, and I'm going to get a second Democrat or a second right. Republican who'll be a co-patron.
So well, it sounds like you have to really, really do your due diligence. You can't just walk in and be like, I have this idea, because it could be something that's already like been in front of them many times and other people are working on it. So you really have to know where that issue is in your state, right, before you walk
absolutely.
In.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's what you do before the legislative session is you gather all your information, you try to see. And, you know, people are afraid to do this, but you get partners in on it. The more of you there are, the more strong your message is. So do your research ahead of time is the big thing, because these guys don't have time for stuff. You know, they've got millions, not millions, but they've got lots of people who want to meet up with them and convince them of stuff and push laws. They've got stuff they need to get done. And remember, delegates have day jobs, you know. They've got day
right.
jobs that they sustain themselves on. So when they're out of session, they're busy working. So when they come back in, they have very tight schedules and they have very finite number of hours that they can spend on your issue. So be very, you know, be very targeted in what you're doing.
Make that time count. Another question for you, which might sound silly, but I mean, like, it's a real question to have. Like, let's say you meet the chief of staff. How do you know that chief of staff is actually going to get anything that you're leaving there to the delegate or the senator?
I mean, that's a tricky question. But what you have to do is, you know, do your level best to kind of vet that person, make a relationship. So, you know, and that's the thing I tell everybody is it's about relationship building. It's kind of like with everything that you do. You have to have a relationship. You have to make sure that person's understanding you. You have to be consistent in your outreach, too, because if you drop off the radar after leaving the room, it's not much good. They're not going to remember you. So being not, you know, persistent but not pesky is an art, and you have to learn it. Always, you know, there's always an option of latching onto other people that kind of know how to do this and have done it before in order to carry your issue further if you feel that you are not very good at those skills. So yeah, I mean, it's a hit or miss, but being persistent pretty much works, I think, especially, and this is, I think you learned this probably from the larger election as well, but if you do lots of phone-ins and call your rep to badger or pester them about something, you will get their ear. Believe me, the phone call stuff really works. When they're inundated with phone calls, they feel like they need to get moving on an issue. And the pressure really works. And remember, these are people that could potentially go up to Congress. They represent you. And they, you know, you have that power over them. So the Congress, and I think somebody sent this in a message to us, but, you know, the real power doesn't lie with Trump. It lies with Congress. And that's absolutely correct. And those are the people that you are vetting and you are electing and you are sending up there. So it does start at a local level, and you do need to know how to push them. Yeah. And the other way to do it is through public hearings, where you take that one pager and you're very, you know, precise about your statistics. You make tons of copies of it to give out to the media if they're showing up for the hearing. You can bring a person. I cannot tell you how many hearings I've been to where people have brought in somebody with an illness or somebody with a situation that's an example of what they're trying to push through in the legislation. It's very effective because that person speaks directly to the reps and tells them of their personal story. Personal stories are a big deal because these people represent you. They want to make sure you're happy. And you're
Sarah,
okay.
When you say public hearing, you're talking about the hearings that take place in the legislature, right? Or are you talking about just setting up your own hearing? What are you talking about?
Well,
here?
There's two types of hearings, okay? There's public hearings that are the town hall style, that are out in the public. They get televised. You get to watch them on your local version of C-SPAN or whatever. But then there's also hearings that happen in your General Assembly where you are able to take your issue and go speak to your legislators. You're put on the docket, basically. So, and you can use these tactics for either one of those, you know, being able to express your suffering, take somebody up there with you.
How do you get to testify? How do you get to testify in the General Assembly?
That's a good question. I mean, I think you have to actually be on the docket through your rep. That rep has to be introduce you as their guest and has to have you up there speaking about that. So again, it's all about that relationship building. And it's not impossible. You just have to know how to do it. You have to take the time out. It is very time intensive. So if you're someone who's extremely, extremely busy with their jobs, it's tough. But there are ways to do it. People have set aside the time to do stuff that means a lot to them. So the key here is to start the process when the budgets are being set. For instance, in Virginia here, it's in December that the state budget's being set. And so you know how money is going to be allocated for specific causes. And then you can start to see where the priorities of your state are. That's the time that you find the patron and you define your goal. You start to build momentum, trying to find partners and other organizations or interest groups that have been already doing this or want to jump on board with you. And you have to be very cognizant of the time frames and the scopes of what you're trying to achieve. Don't go ask for something that's way, you know, too much of an ask because you don't have that much time to hone in on what you really, really want. Keep visiting the legislators. I mean, their doors are open all the time. You can go to your district and meet with them when they're down at their district levels, when they're not up at the General Assembly. Their doors are open. They are actually your servants. They're your public servants. They're out there. Their job is to take care of what you want. And that's what people don't realize because they get kind of intimidated by who people can be sometimes.
Right.
So attend these subcommittee hearings too. They can be really dry and boring, but if you're interested in that topic, you get to know the ins and outs of like issues by attending these subcommittee hearings that can run for hours sometimes, but you're free to record these as well, by the way. You can actually go in and record the entire hearing for your own self. And I would say, you know, these are the ways to push this before all the bills go through the legislature during your legislative session for your state. And then it finally goes to the governor, who gets to decide what happens to it. So each state has its own schedule. So you have to research your own structure and timeline. It's not hard. You can go on to, you know, there's websites out there that can help you to find out how your system works. But the punchline is that you're most effective in your immediate surroundings. And it's very important to elect the right people to represent you in Congress or in any office that runs your state and local level. So consider running for office yourself. I mean, always vote, try to work on a campaign that helps to understand the system. And then, you know, if you're going to be fighting for a cause, just push for that legislation and know what the issues are on your ballot, because there's local elections happening all the time. People don't know that, you know, X election at the municipal level is going to be deciding on the park that's right behind my house. And I need to be part of that decision because it affects the traffic through my house area. It affects the parking. It affects the type of people that are going to be around my neighborhood. So,
you know, you said something about, like, you know, consider running yourself. And I saw a graph a few days ago, and I wish I had held on to it, that showed that the Democrats people who are announcing that they're going to run as a Democrat, like in upcoming local, state, and national elections, has just skyrocketed. Like, you know, so there are many, many more people who are like jumping into different races, which I think is great. But my question is, like, for somebody who wants to, like, let's say, run on a local level, let's say for General Assembly or something, I mean, what do you, don't you need like a massive like funding? You need a lot of money, you need like a team, you need like, what is, you know, what kind of resources are we talking about for somebody who's considering
that?
Yeah,
good point, because a lot of people have failed in their campaign because they weren't able to raise enough money. And that is a conundrum, because if you're running for the House level, obviously you have to keep your day job because it doesn't pay that much. And so you're running after the money. You also have to set up a district office. You have to have an office up in the General Assembly. You have to have a campaign staff. You have to hire people. And yeah, it gets expensive and it can be very draining. I know people who've dropped out of races because it's impossible or it's really tough for them to maintain the two things. But it's an art and you have to be really dedicated. This is a real test of, you know, your desire to be a public servant, is how much it takes. Tremendous, you know, personal sacrifice. It's family time. It's running about, speaking at places, dealing with a lot of publicity. Some, you know, the negative publicity can be kind of painful too, you know?
Yeah.
If you're going to run for office, you have to be really serious about it. You have to set aside a lot of things in your personal life to take that on. So when I have a tremendous respect for people at the state level, because it takes a lot for them to get where they are. And it shows your level of devotion to your causes, or just to your state, to your country, to your people, you know. But, you know, one area that I saw consistently in my work was people not being aware of the issues on the ballot, because they're always whining about, say, that crossing on the road that just is so nonsensical. But then they don't really see that, you know, there's ways that they can get those things changed. And they're kind of simple. You know, you have county supervisors, you have municipal level elections and city councils that you can go through to make those changes happen. So always know who your local rep is, by the way. Everybody kind of knows who the Trumps and the Rex Tillersons and all the other people of the world are. But it's really amazing when you ask somebody, who's your local delegate or who's your senator? People like draw a blank, or who's your governor even. So, you know, if you're going to be involved in this, you're going to speak in an intelligent way, you have to know what's in your immediate surrounding before you kind of go out. It's kind of the ripple effect, you know. So use your county websites to get all the electoral information that you want on candidates and the issues on the ballot during your election cycle. And just stay aware, you know, stay aware of what's going on, because your state politics is very influential on your life. And people underestimate that. They think it's all coming from the federal level. Well, not really.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah, because honestly, like this entire process, like the nuts and bolts of it and exactly how to do the advocacy, like that's very helpful for me, because even though I think and write and talk about a lot of these issues, like on a very local level, like there's state level like criminal justice reforms that I'm interested in. And if I ever get a chance to breathe, there are some issues that I want to use exactly the tips and techniques you talked about, getting the appointments, doing the research. research and seeing if we can actually make some change on, if I can help in any of these issues that concern me. So I really, really appreciate that. And I hope our listeners, and you know, actually, I would love to hear back from listeners who actually do this, who actually say, okay, we're going to take these tools and, you know, these tips that Sarah taught us and pick an issue that is important to you. And we'd love to hear back about the process and how things go for you. We're going to take a couple listener questions. I'll let you pick first. Which email do you want to address?
Okay, so I wanted to apologize to somebody who works in the medical field. She's a doctoral candidate, a clinical psychologist at Miami University, and she mentioned that I use the word schizophrenic to describe people or things that are merely inconsistent or incoherent. And I think because of the field of work, you know, as an adult, I really try to correct myself right away because I feel like if you make a mistake, you got to accept it. You got to straighten it out before it's too late. So I just wanted to apologize and say I will not use that word anymore, and total deference to the fact that there are people who have this as a medical condition. And if I was offensive in any way, I just wanted to say I apologize, and you know, thanks for catching that and putting me on the right path. I appreciate it. And this is a message from, I guess, Julia Kaufman.
Thank you so much, Julia, and thank you, Sarah, for your very gracious response there. I mean, I think, you know, we do these kinds of things all the time. All of us do that. Sometimes we'll use language that we're not thinking through what it might mean from a different perspective. Because honestly, like you said, like if you said it in the past, I didn't catch it. It didn't. No red flag went up for me, but when I read this email, I'm like, oh, this is a good point. It's an important point.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
The email that I want to address is from Eileen Sullivan, who has written kind of a lengthy email. I'm not going to read the whole thing. And she is very, very gracious, and she's, you know, she's liberal leaning, but, you know, she really does value your perspective, Sarah. I think one of the important, which, you know, we get that all the time. I think our majority of our listener base are liberal leaning, but they, many people do really express that they really value your perspective.
I get dismissed from the other side. You're not a real conservative. You're not a real Republican because you're just wishy-washy. I'm like, no, some of us are thoughtful. Thank you.
Yeah. No, I think you're doing it right. But this is an interesting point that she brings up, and I think this is actually an important point. And she talks specific, she says that, you know, there are times when we discuss something and there'll be some back and forth, or we disagree on something, and we disagree on it as if it is an issue of interpretation versus the facts. And she gives two specific examples of discussions, arguments, whatever we've had in the past. One about healthcare and the Cruz Amendment, specifically what it means, and the other one about the opioids epidemic. And, you know, I'm going to use the opioid epidemic as illustrative of what she's saying. But what happened in that conversation was that I said that, you know, rural white America is hardest hit, and you said, no, I don't believe so. And I said, no, it is so. And the point she's making, and I think this is an actually really important point, this is what she says, and I'm quoting, "The waters are muddied for people listening to this podcast who have not paid close attention to the recent ongoings in healthcare legislation," but she means in general. But she says, "I hope in the future the podcast will include more source citation to keep all participants grounded in the facts," right? So, for example, on the opioid issue. Now, I'm going to quote directly from an NPR article that is titled "Why Opioid Epidemic is Hitting Rural America Especially Hard," right? And this article talks about specifically that it is rural white America, and there are many articles like this that are getting hit heaviest by this. And so, you know, that's my source citation. Like, so what she's saying is that, you know, if you're going to make an argument, back it up. And I think that's fair.
I think I'm not defending myself, but I am kind of trying to clarify that the stories that I have read, and I'm not going to pick one in particular, have said that it's an indiscriminate kind of problem. So, you know, the opioid crisis and people being hooked on drugs is across the board, across different socioeconomic backgrounds and races. I wouldn't be surprised if you were correct to say that it hits rural white America more, just because that is what rural America is made up of. So I'm not denying it. I just said I've heard that there's no specific target or specific group that's more vulnerable. Everybody is, because everyone's getting hooked on it.
But that's not actually true. That's not actually true. And there's actually a reason that rural white America is more vulnerable to this particular epidemic, and that is this. And this is, again, according to the NPR article, but also many other folks who are studying this epidemic, really, is because the way people get addicted to opioids is different than, like, other kinds of illicit drugs. In these situations, it begins mostly with being addicted to painkillers. Those painkillers are usually prescribed to people who, like, have medical conditions, and really the only thing they can do, I mean, maybe they don't have, like, the therapeutic options. So they get, and so these local doctors in these small towns, the only thing they can offer these patients are painkillers in many instances. And that thing, that just builds and builds and becomes like these opioid addictions. And so it can morph into heroin addiction, because people are taking these as kind of dulling mechanisms to help with pain, and then it becomes an addiction. So there is actually more of a vulnerability to populations because they have more access to these drugs versus other kinds of things. And so
there's other aspects to this, Robbie. And
no, there's other aspects, but I'm talking strictly about, look, see, I do agree that, like, we shouldn't be a show of alternative facts. Facts are facts. If the facts are showing that there is more opioid use in rural America than there is in the inner cities, then we're
not
going to
argue that.
Right.
I'm not going to argue that. But I think what I said, if you go back to the piece, was in context of who the targets are or who the most vulnerable are. I guess that's true, that it's probably rural America. And it's closely tied to socioeconomic backgrounds. If people in cities might have more opportunity, might have more economic means of finding ways to deal with their illnesses, whereas rural America, you know, white Americans probably feel out there in the boonies, there's a job issue, and so they get hooked on these things. I get all that, and I wasn't arguing with the fact that that might have been the target audience. But I've heard
the target audience of what?
Everybody's
of
vulnerable.
What? I'm a little confused about what you mean by target audience.
As in, if you go to a doctor in the city, and the doctor in the city is, you're telling me they're less prone to giving out pain meds to somebody in pain. I think it's just that people might be in a socioeconomic condition where they're able to they're more informed about what they're having and what the threat are to getting addicted to it versus somebody out in the rural area who sees it as the end all and be all of the solution.
Sure. I mean, look, the reason we were even having this conversation was because of, for me, the framing of this as a healthcare epidemic, healthcare crisis versus a criminalized behavior, which is what we see with drug use for inner cities, people of color, is precisely because most people who are suffering from this are rural whites. And that is why legislators are looking and talking about this. And even the media is talking about this completely differently than they talk about other kinds of drug use. I mean, I'm reading right now a University of Michigan study that found the rates of babies born with opioid withdrawal symptoms, meaning their mothers were addicted, is rising much faster in rural areas than urban ones. There is a racial component to this issue, which I think is important.
I think it's by default, though, because I think what's happening is it's the socioeconomic setting and the background that they just get hooked to it a lot faster, I guess, than people in cities who have more opportunities, more alternatives,
right.
And more understanding of
that. That is probably
all
true.
So if they happen to be white, they happen to be white. But I'm not going to argue with that. But I'm saying everyone's prone to it. And we've been seeing that happen.
The question is, why is one kind of addiction criminalized and the other one looked at as a healthcare issue that needs funding to fight through a healthcare lens? This is an important question, I think, for all of us to really think deeply about. So I think the premise of our listener's question was, listen, if you're going to come to the table with an opinion, back it up. And so I pointed to a story. I gave you the title. You can go look it up. And that story has links to lots of different studies, and you can take a look there. That's the evidence I'm bringing to the table on this issue. But I do think it's fair that going forward, that we do try to have, like, okay, you guys can, this is my source, this is where I'm finding it from, instead of saying I've read, which I do, though. I do that all the time, too. So.
Yeah, and by the way, Eileen had a second point about the healthcare bill that I had stated that it wants to bring both sides together. It was designed to do that. I'm not going to make a value judgment on whether or not it did, but I did mention that it was an attempt to do that. And that's, you know, the word reconciliation's in there. Now, whether or not you think it is, it's up to you. I mean, I think it's got a lot of issues with it, obviously, but
You know, I think when you have a process that does not allow Democratic legislators to interject a single amendment, then I have to question the premise that it's a design to bring them together. But that's a very specific conversation about that. And, you know, sometimes it's I don't know. Again, I don't know if it's an issue of alternative facts or we're just seeing the situation completely differently. I don't know which it is. So
no, I'm not disagreeing. Anyhow. I state the facts in terms of, you know, that's what it was intended to be. Now you figure out if it is or isn't. Obviously, the actions show otherwise. But,
yeah.
You know, I think I mentioned it as a description of how the process was supposed to work.
All right. Great. All right. Thank you so much, listeners. Keep emailing. Sarah, thank you so much. Good luck with the remainder of your move. And I'll see you next week.
Thanks.
All right, take care. Bye, guys. Thanks for tuning in again this week, and we really hope to keep coming to you weekly, but in order to do that, we do need your support. So please consider becoming a patron of the 45th Podcast. To do that, just go to our Patreon page. It's www.patreon.com/45thpod. Again, that's patreon.com/45thpod, and Patreon is spelled Patreon. A big thank you, of course, to everybody who helps make this show possible, beginning with our fantastic sponsors. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you to Ray Gaines for our audio production, our kick-ass producer, Mithal Thelhan. Thank you. You are the best. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Please do check out our website at www.45thpod.com. And you can reach us and leave us your listener messages, which we love to check into, at 202-670-8345. Again, it's 202-670-8345. Thanks again. See you guys next week. Scaramucci, the Mooch. Am I saying his name right? I can just call him the Mooch, so I don't have to mess up his name.
He's a sharp dresser.
You know, I'll tell you this. When I saw his first briefing, I was a little bit impressed. I was like, all right, well, Spicy's not there, but this is not too bad. And then things went downhill very rapidly.
Oh, God.
Did you read the article, actually, in the New Yorker?